For those of you who are new, I'm Paul Rohde, campus pastor at Augustana University, and our question for the week has been, what will shape the future? We've been looking at dimensions of change that we're experiencing now and looking for parallel experiences in the Bible to see if the Bible can help us talk about the changes we're experiencing. My observations is not only that we're experiencing exponentially dramatic change, but that we're having a really difficult time talking about it, that talk tends to be polarizing or worse. And so I've had a great week. I hope you have too. We started in Deuteronomy, where the children of Israel are about to go into the promised land and listen to the way Moses called them to listen to God. And then we talked about Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, three different biblical formulations of community, us, them, us, us, and seeing the stranger as a gift and bringing gifts. Yesterday, we went to Isaiah, where we have a broad and complex interpretation of the Babylonian exile. The city of Jerusalem had been destroyed. It was an extremely violent situation. And Isaiah helps diagnose both how it happened and how to respond to it. So now my apology. I had no idea that it said that violence was supposed to be today on the board. I knew what I was going to do, so I have been looking at the board. It had violence for today and technology for yesterday. So we're doing technology today. We had enough violence yesterday, right? And today, well, before I do that, just a couple follow-up things from today. There are some great comments after the session yesterday, a couple of them from Larry. One of the things he mentioned is that we had talked about the Search Institute and their research on developmental assets in kids. And one of the things that I pointed out I thought you'd be interested in is that the Search Institute used both theologians and social scientists. So talk about us, them. Here's another bridge and integration, that both from scientific points of view as well as theological points of view. We won't get very far in the technology discussion before I'll say that I'm going to be in touch with the Search Institute to see if they're updating the assets in light of what the way technology is changing our world. For example, one of the assets is time at home. That's a very powerful asset for young people. But I have a hunch that time at home in the assets means interaction with people. And increasingly, it may or may not mean that. It may need to be stated more explicitly. Second comment that Larry pointed out that I think we really want to be sensitive to is the exasperation of Native Americans, that the word tribalism now is taking on hugely negative connotations for a meaning totally different than what tribe means to Native Americans. In fact, one of the things I told you a little about going to Pine Ridge with students. One of the ways we approach the discussion there is to talk about different kinds of poverty. You bring up the word poverty, and everybody assumes economic poverty. That's how we use it most often. But we aren't at Pine Ridge very long before there are other dimensions of poverty in terms of heritage, community, ritual, that are alive and powerful and encouraging. We quickly discovered that we have things to learn from the way a tribe is a community. So I thought that was a really important corrective. And then Kendra, I don't know that Kendra's in the room yet, but came up to talk about how she got stuck at the very beginning of Isaiah 1 because Jerusalem was compared to Sodom and Gomorrah. And the irony there, biblically, where for centuries the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah has been assumed to be sexual sin, but it is in fact a sin of hospitality and violence. And so takes us even more deeply into what we were trying to say about neglect of the oppressed, neglect of the orphan. May not feel violent, but it is in fact a violation. Okay? So today we're going to talk about technology. I'm going to limit the discussion just to communication technology because that works the best with the historical comparison. So we're not using the Bible this morning. But we've had such a great run with the Bible that I thought I would proof text. Okay? I'm going to give you one verse, one of my favorites from Ecclesiastes 12, verse 11. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Amen? Okay. Because the technology we're going to talk about is making many books. So we will compare it with the 16th century. But I thought this would be a very different kind of discussion because it's not going to lean so much on biblical or historical knowledge. We've all got technological experience, and I'll be eager to hear your perceptions. So start with turning to your neighbor and the question, what is your favorite device or platform? In what ways is it a gift? And why do you really like it? And what is its shadow? So when does I think of shadow as when a strength becomes a weakness. So it's when a well-organized person becomes rigid, you know, or when a very approachable person is always late, that kind of thing. So all of our devices and our uses of devices may have a shadow side. Be curious if you can identify that. Just talk for a few seconds.
What's your favorite?
Give some examples. What are your favorite devices and when do they become shadows? Or when do you realize that there's a shadow side to using them? Go ahead.
I love my phone. I love GPS on my phone that I can like talk to people when I'm driving, which I do a lot of. But I'm also a teacher. I teach middle school students, and the effects that their phones have on them is really visible. They don't interpret nonverbal cues. Like, even 10 years ago kids could do when I first became a teacher. So they don't communicate well with one another in person because they're so used to going through a digital device.
Okay.
And it's super bad watching kids argue about something and you're like, what? They're like, no, I just said sit down. I didn't say you were a bad person. I didn't say I hated you, I just want you to sit down. But that's how they interpret it because they don't interpret the subtext of what I'm saying and how I'm saying it.
So. Excellent. That's a great start. Thanks. And others?
Well, this is kind of a weird observation. We take public transportation in the Seattle area into town, and many times I'll be sitting there looking around, and nobody's talking to anybody else. They're all looking at their music, their email. It loses conversation and getting to know about people.
Go ahead, Becca.
I've only had an iPhone for 2 years. I was a flip phone person till then, and I love it because I'm curious, and anything I want to look up, I can look up on my phone whenever I want to. But when I'm sitting and talking with people, and I suddenly think, oh, I wonder what that means or what the derivation of that word is. I'm like Frodo in the ring, trying to keep my hand away from my
The sessions come together. Exactly. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would echo that and kind of extend it to the, I love being able to look something up just in a moment. Right. The number of times I've been sitting on with friends debating something and I'm like, oh, we all have that answer in the palm of our hand right now. Yeah. But at the same time, I feel like I hold so much less knowledge within me now.
Exactly.
Because it's all just there. And I don't have to actually remember anything because I can look it up instantaneously.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. We'll take one more. Christy, go ahead.
I just, to add to that, I also wonder what that does to our sense of wonder when everything, we were in the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota a few years ago, and our joke became, like when we would be talking about something we didn't know the answer to, we would all shout into the ether, Google! But it was like sort of free, like I guess we won't know.
Jeff, go ahead.
I am retired, but do have some commitments, and so I get a lot of email communication, and something just occurred to me. So I get a lot of stuff to read that comes in by email, but where it can be a downfall or a problem is the reply all. do I need to read this? Why was there a reply all?
And a second cousin of that is the attachment feature, where the documents all get attached, and suddenly you've got 200 pages of attachments.
Yep.
And a friend of mine is a principal of an elementary school, and he talked about how, you know, especially as email was new in school communication, teachers would copy him in on all the communication with parents. And so as an administrator, you know, what was happening to his box and their assumption that he knew about all of their situations. And I said, what would have happened before email? He said, teachers would have just dealt with it. You know, and if it went okay, it would, he didn't need to know about it. But this kind of quantity of information is huge. Okay.
I think we haven't mentioned this, but Facebook is the big villain. Not only the time waster, but because Facebook reads your opinions and so forth, it aligns you up with people who share your attitudes and reinforces some of your lesser impulses. And so you have to work really hard sometimes to break out of that so you can listen to people or talk to people who are different.
And you can't buy your wife's Christmas present on the home computer. Because I did that one year. We had redone our family room and we decided we were going to put tree pictures in it. So I bought a tree painting for Susan for Christmas. And she said, she sat down that night, somewhere she said, I was on Facebook and art.com, they've got these great tree paintings. One of the things I think is important is to be clear about how we define technology. And I don't even know where I got this definition. But for a functional definition, I would offer that technology is anything that extends our grasp. Okay, so many times we think of technology as only the electronic sorts of gadgets.
Yeah.
But the wheel was the shovels, basic machines, a bicycle, a car, all of these extend our grasp. Correction lenses, any number of aspirin, ibuprofen helps you hike further, okay? This is, it's a techno, synthetic kind of way to help us hike further. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about a technological device that was very important in the 16th century. Now, no historian would call the 16th century ancient, but when you live in a world where the iPhone 5 is ancient, you know, 16th century is a long time back then. I want to say that I think Luther was a fabulous theologian, but Lutheran theologians have tended to overlook the way his impact was affected by technology. So that's what we're going to talk about first. And then we're going to compare that to the information explosion that we're experiencing and see what we can learn from the two. So first of all, just a few words about the way power was understood in the Middle Ages. Power was very vertical. It's not accidental that the cathedrals of Europe are high. Earth was seen as bad, and earth was bad. The plague in the Middle Ages was horrible. Life was hard. People eking out a living, the Black Plague. You know, there's any number of things that made life very difficult. And heaven was above. God was above. And the point of faith was to get us out of this horrible life and up into the paradise that God was creating for us. So it was all about a vertical kind of point of view, and the view was collapsing. It's fascinating. The cathedral's fascinating architecturally because of the things they designed. You know, the cathedral in Chartres has the labyrinth on the floor, and the rose window is built so that the light comes through that rose window to shine exactly on the labyrinth. That could be figured out geometrically is just amazing to me. But they were trying to build, I think it's Mainz. Do you know, Roy, that has the highest cathedral spire?
And the hydral is actually in Salisbury. Salisbury,
okay.
Cathedral.
Salisbury has that. But they were trying to build it bigger, and the walls would collapse. They reached the, and it's kind of a symbol of the limits of the point of view. I want to be very careful when we move to theology. When I speak about the Reformation, I try to be disciplined to talk about the medieval church. And as the 500th anniversary of the Reformation happened in 2017, I was really grateful for the way current Roman Catholic voices were included in that discussion. So, for example, when PBS did their documentary on the Reformation and the 500th anniversary, the corruption of the medieval church was presented by an archbishop from New York. So a Roman Catholic saying, these were the issues of the church of that day. Because if we say Roman Catholic, there are just too many misunderstandings that continue to be perpetuated. When in fact, there were a lot of Catholics who were very disturbed by the abuses. So following this vertical point of view, we've seen that the treasures of God were mediated. There's this kind of chain of being through religious folks. And so God, Pope, bishops, clergy, monks, nuns, and then common folk. And it was all top down, meted down, and the indulgences were, of course, the spark that ignited the fire, and a lot of that was about it was about theology for Luther, but it was also about justice because it was really exploitive of very poor people. The reason I'm not going to dwell a lot on Luther's theology today is because many of his theological insights have been discussed for a long time. John Huss in Bohemia, Wycliffe in England, others were saying the same thing. But in the meantime, Gutenberg had invented the movable type printing press in 1439. There's an irony here, a huge irony, that among the first things printed were the certificates of indulgence. So hundreds of thousands of indulgences had been printed on the machine, and then in 1455, the Gutenberg Bible was printed. In December of 1517, the 95 Theses were printed. Luther was a publishing sensation. He reportedly nailed the 95 Theses to the door. It was a bulletin board. This was not a violation. On the door in Wittenberg. How many of you have been in Wittenberg? Yeah. Okay, so you've seen the doors now have the 95 Theses etched into them. On October 31st, 1517. That's my birthday. And so I think my state was sealed. Born on Reformation Day in Maine, Paul.
When I had 1517.
I was thinking about taking wine to heart like for you, but I changed my mind. October 31st is my birthday. And the joke was supposed to be, born on Reformation Day named Paul, do you think my fate was sealed? within 3 weeks, the 95 Theses were all over Germany. And within months, they were all over Europe. So the awareness of this debate, nothing happened in Wittenberg. Near as we can tell, there never was a debate in Wittenberg. But there was a debate all over Europe. Now the thing I want you to think about is imagine if you are a bishop or a priest, okay? So you are one of maybe 5% of people in your world who are literate, who can read. And books have only been hand copied up until very recent history. And you have access to the book, okay? And everything about your worldview says that your place in the world is to mediate these treasures from God down to other folks. And to make it only about the book would be a very Lutheran approach to this. The whole sacramental system was about meeting merit down to the common folk. Okay, this is your job. And suddenly, almost everybody has access to this information. What would happen to your power? Not just to your sense of power, but to your power.
Poof.
Poof. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, so there's social disruption on many levels. I'll say a little bit more about that. But first of all, I want to introduce another important character, Lucas Cranach. When I did congregational forums in 2017, for the 500th anniversary, I did Reformation cast of characters. Another one of my arguments with the Reformation is that so much is made of Martin Luther that the people who are around him and with him get diminished. And they are fascinating characters. Cranach is one of them. He was the court painter in Saxony, an apothecary, a very successful businessman, printer on the town council and mayor of Wittenberg, a close friend of Martin Luther. They were godparents for each other's children, and he illustrated the Bible and the small catechism and leaflet. So he's mostly known for his portraits, but his woodcuts are fabulous. So for example, this is the meaning of the second commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, in the small catechism. And the translation of the meaning is that your name is rightly honored through right teaching and belief and through that praised and preached. So here we have preaching and praise to illustrate the meaning. So that if you can't read, you can see through the pictures. I love that we could spend all day on this painting of law and gospel. So this is the law side. You notice the tree is dead. So the fire got to this side of the tree. They're pointing at the law, and the man is fleeing. God is remote and distant. They're recalling the Garden of Eden. A little slam here at the beginning of the construction of St. Peter's. And then the gospel side, where the John the Baptist is pointing to the resurrection. The person is free to come. Jesus has come closer. So if you can't read about law and gospel, you can see how the law is death and the gospel is freedom and life in his illustration.
Paul,
go ahead.
What's down in this corner?
Lion and lamb. I'm not sure.
Lion and lamb?
Well, the lamb, but what's underneath it?
A skeleton.
I don't know. It didn't reproduce well enough to really see.
Well, because isn't the skeleton representing the law? So the law is dead through the resurrection.
Yeah, it could be.
And the lamb is standing on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lion.
And I don't know, Roy, have you studied this thing?
I have looked at it. I always thought it was a reference to the Isaiah passage, lion shall lie down with the lamb, but.
Yeah, oh, the lion and the lamb.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's a skeleton.
It's just really hard for me to see it.
Sorry.
No. Curiosity is great. And did anybody say us, them? These caricatures of the Pope as devil and Antichrist riding on a beast and devouring the people. Here he is, and they're counting. You know, they're counting what they've earned. How many of you have been to St. Peter's in Rome? So you've seen the stones on the floor where the St. Peter's had to be bigger than any other cathedral in Europe, and they marked it on the floor so this would not escape your attention, that this was the biggest cathedral. It's almost like when the world is, when the vertical is crumbling, it's that we'll give you vertical. It is the most absolutely vertical place in the universe. And we'll talk about it at coffee, okay, because I don't want to get us off track, but I have that feeling sometimes about institutions in our day. As institutions are crumbling, they are becoming more rigid and more difficult. And I grieve that because I want institutions to be helpful. As I told the folks on Monday, one of my questions is, what is going to hold us together? And institutions held us together imperfectly, but they had a way of belonging, you know, making belonging concrete and tangible. So, all of this, well, what happens to power? We've already talked a bit about that. Now, Luther is going to be critical of this. He came out of hiding in the Wartburg Castle after he had translated the New Testament because he was hearing about the abuses of the power of the common folk, the iconoclasts, who were seizing the power and destroying the earth. I don't remember the exact statistic now. I heard at the Vatican Museum of what percentage of European art is in Italy because it didn't have a Reformation. And the Reformation destroyed all the art. And so Luther came out to try to recover some sort of appropriate sense of authority because this having been unleashed, it was just going wild. I mean, the way the power was diminished. Any questions or comments? If we're going to think about changing power structures, what comes to mind with what technology is doing in our day? What assumptions about power are being turned on their head? Go ahead, Kyle.
Because of things like Facebook in particular, as well as the internet generally, you no longer have that wall of crime, right? Everyone listens to this guy, gets their news from this person. Everyone can find their own news, whether it's true or not.
Yeah, exactly. And powerful people in our world have discovered they don't need to work with the media. They go directly to the whole role of journalism. So its power and its calling to critique abuses of power is at stake. Go ahead.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, is that journalism data can be hidden, but through journalism and requests for information, we can pull back the curtain and see, because they are all keeping data on themselves, if you can get the data, it can be very revealing.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Go ahead.
There's a, with the way that we access the internet being limited by certain companies, there's a new set of gateways to knowledge in the world that I think in some ways mirrors what we saw pre-Reformation, of there are certain people who hold access to all this knowledge. And they're able to kind of filter down what we see and how we see that through, you know, we access it through Google or Microsoft or Facebook or something, that knowledge is getting filtered to us in ways that we're not choosing.
Larry told us the other day that, you know, the search engines keep track of what you do, and so you can search, for example, white supremacy, and not get the same information depending on what they know about your political preferences. I think about the power of parenting and the way it has changed. There are some kinds of controls on electronic devices, but kids are very good at finding their way through it. That is scary to me, honestly. I mean, it's hilarious when we got to Tanzania, going out to the school is very remote, northwest corner of Tanzania, and we're in the van, and it's like every question we asked the people was the worst possible answer. What's in our house, we said? Almost nothing, they said. Do we have a stove? No. Do we have a refrigerator? No. And then, you know, several other questions later, we said, they told us to buy a network. We had bought a cell phone in Tanzania, and we had to decide what network. We had no idea. So we guessed, we just bought Vodacom. Will Vodacom work? And they went, so we've been there a week. Inga called, our youngest daughter called us one of the first days. We held it by the window of the house, and we got just a little data. Maybe we talked to her for 2 minutes, and then we lost the call. It was an exercise in frustration. About a week later, the students heard us talking about this, and one of them said, oh, you have Vodacom? Go over there by that rock. or go down the road to the right to where the trees are. I was like, I work at a university. You know, if you have trouble with your technology, ask the students. Go ahead.
So how do you feel at Holden there's a stratification of access to the internet?
You know, one of the questions I want to, we'll come back to that. Before we do that, I just wonder what you're noticing by being at Holden about being unplugged.
People, go ahead. Talking to each other. And this really bothers me as a teacher and a parent to see families walking or a mother walking to the mother's on the phone. The kid is trying to get her attention. And it's, you know, what lesson are you giving to your child that this device is much more important than you are? And here we talk to each other. Yeah. And it's wonderful.
Okay. Other reactions? Go ahead.
This is a little different from the last time I was here because you can store so much more music now on your device even if it's not attached to Wi-Fi or data. But I'm a musician, and so it's just fun hearing people like make music. Somebody pulls out a guitar, so then there's like 8 people, and you're trying to remember the words to that one song that everybody knows part of. Like, that used to be just the common experience of everybody everywhere, and it's not anymore.
I think I appreciate freedom from distraction. Yeah. You know, I check my email way too often at home. And I don't have to, but it's there. And there are almost always some messages that need to be dealt with. But to just be freed of that distraction is great. Go ahead.
I found out that instead of waking up in the morning and going to my news app and being upset most of the time, now I'm waking up and it's just like,
I miss the texting. You know, the rest I think it's good to, you know, be away from, but like even I wanted to get a hold of Sue the other day and think, how do you get a hold of them? Where do you find somebody?
So go ahead, one more and then we'll get to your question.
The flip side of all this is that young people need to know that stuff because the technology is more and more integral to everything. And
that's
they
right.
need to know their way around cyberspace, even to fix a car.
Mm-hmm. Which is a huge change at Holden. So you brought the question of stratification. I'll just start by saying that's a very recent change at Holden Village. I was elected to the board in 98, and I want to say for sure my first term, served 2 6-year terms. All of my first term, there was one satellite phone in the village that was kept under lock and key. There were two directors, they had keys to the lock. And maybe one of the other managers had it, but they had to keep a log of when the phone was used and for what purpose, and report that to the board. Because we had done a study, and the top three mission characteristics were daily Christ-centered worship, vigorous teaching, and a place apart. And the reasoning on the board was that if communication technology comes up here, we're going to cease to be a place apart. But then satellite phones became more common. And so we had a number of guests coming in with satellite phones. And young people had figured out the tops of which mountains they could talk on. I mean, so it was like, why, in the staff orientation, why don't they tell us where to use our phone? All of that was, and it, I remember saying to the board at one point that if we continue that same policy, that the only people who wouldn't be able to have phones here were the people who lived here and kept it going. And that seemed really unfair, because everybody else had that option. I mean, you're right, there's a stratification. Some of that is that there isn't enough bandwidth up here for everybody to be online. That's the main, and none of us can stream. So there just can't be any streaming, or it would shut down the whole system. Until remediation, the hydro plant wasn't reliable, electricity wasn't nearly as reliable. So there would be power shortages almost daily. The power would just go out, and you know, we didn't have mics, we didn't have PowerPoints when we taught here. And we did just fine, as we all did in our own lives. But now it's here. And registration-wise, for example, it was amazing how quickly that moved. When they went from a mail, you know, you would send in your registration, and you'd have to list first, second, third choice, and you wouldn't know for probably 2 weeks when you got in, if you got in. And so, I mean, I don't know, that's just some perspective, but what do you think about the stratification that staff can be online and...
I think it's, you see, staff, board, faculty, I mean, there are many layers of this.
Yeah. It's power, right?
It's power.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's power, it's also release. I mean...
What do you say?
Well, like... If you're here for a short time, yeah, there's a part of me that wants to get on. But there's a part of me that wants to just say to the rest of the world, I'll be back down, and don't disturb me.
We have
for a week or two. And that's freeing, too.
This would have been in the late 90s. We were coming up here. The pastor with whom I was working found a cartoon that showed a couple hiking in the mountains. And there was a helicopter above them. And the pilot had a megaphone shouting down, your church is called 23 times. They can't find the communion wafers. And I said to Todd, that's why I go to Holy Village. Nobody can reach us here. And but we had a friend who was up here long term, and she was checking her email. She hadn't told anybody there was email up here, and learned that a friend had passed away. So her impulse, of course, was to send an email back. It's just her reaction. But she knew if she did, she'd blow her cover. And you know, we don't make much of that with our families, because I think our moms know it's here. We have sent them emails, but it's like, we say, oh, it's really unreliable, it's hard to get on, and that's not
untrue.
It's true. I mean, that is true. Because otherwise they would expect it and they would worry, you know. So, anyway, I've got this data up here about how much data there is to which we have access, but I'm going to give another example of how this is changing institutions. So, do you know about MOOCs? Massive online, I've got to look it up. Google?
Massive online OpenCourseWare.
You just had massive?
Massive online OpenCourseWare.
Yes. Massive online open courses. Started by MIT, I'm not going through my notes, remembering all the things I thought I was going to include. Stanford University in California now has more than 160 courses online, and they are free. I feel disloyal to my institution telling you that. Since 2011, more than 10 million learners have accessed a Stanford course. So Tom Friedman, in the book I've referred to so often, this Thank You for Being Late, talks about how when industry in the past has had a problem, an issue, a crisis, they would hire the best minds, create a think tank, you know, spend 5 years to solve a problem. Now they put the problem out on the internet. And the solution comes from anywhere. It can come from Southern Asia, it can come from Central Africa. I mean, it is, I think, a very clear parallel to what happened in the Reformation. And higher ed is scrambling to reinterpret itself and to find ways to say that education is not merely information. I mean, but it has been a lot of information. And so to have a human being in the room to teach us to process information or to teach us the way critical thinking transforms our own sense of self or our view of the world, I mean, that is something that isn't the same if you just read about it. Mm-hmm. It's when you talk about it, get into it, but to persuade the world that this is still valuable, and to be honest, to persuade teachers who still think it's about transmitting information, that we've got to be about more than that. I really think that mentorship piece is still there, but there is no question that this is changing the landscape of power and that sort of stratification and the way a degree, an academic degree, was a real certificate in places. I mean, major employers now not requiring degrees. Google is one of them, because if you can learn it and if you can do it.
How do you feel about online seminaries?
Well, I have all the questions I do about every piece of online education. Part of seminary is the formation of character and person. And I think one of the ways you encounter the limits of it, We have a seminary in Sioux Falls that's doing all kinds of things online, but the teachers talk about what it's like to be asked to write a reference for somebody that they have met maybe once in person, or maybe not at all. And what do you put in a reference for being a pastor if you've never been with that person? And this is true of every field. It's certainly true of teaching. You've got to know the subject matter, certainly, but you've also got to have some capacity with students and capacity to engage. And how does that get formed? And what do we say about prayer? And so on. So I got all kinds of questions about it. At the same time, in a state like South Dakota, I recognize the way that's providing access to education. So a number of rural parishes now are finding someone in their faith community who is gifted, and they're able to get education locally, and the parish is being served. Vitality is there. So I want to be balanced with this. I mean, this access to power is not a bad thing, but formation of person is a whole other question. I bet you have some thoughts about this. Go ahead.
I have a question. What does Stanford gain by giving away so much? It's almost as if it's their evil plan to destabilize higher level education.
Yeah. Does anybody know?
They're giving away courses.
Yeah. What did you say?
I don't think they lead to a degrees, but right. They get the courses and people can get badges and so forth, right? But
they don't get a degree.
Yeah.
So we see the same thing in the city of Austin. Churches that are larger than my church are even though they have 1,500 members, their Sunday school programs are disintegrating because parents are finding theological content in their podcasts. Mm-hmm. And so we give away the Word of God, and yet we haven't rebuilt the new community that comes together around that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple sources for us to think about. This book by Jean Twenge, iGen, why today's super connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood, is cited a lot. You hear it on NPR and so on. Among her insights are that the kids are growing up more slowly. For data, she uses starting with when they're left at home alone, to when they get their driver's licenses, their eagerness to get a driver's license or not. A much higher percentage of students graduating from high school never having driven, not necessarily seeking independence, content with having their parents cart them around. And so who such people are when they get to college? I mean, colleges need to pay attention to this, because then suddenly they're thrust into a great deal of independence. But the screen time and its correlation with mental health is discussed in this book. Friendship and its impact, what it does to community, is discussed here. We, our campus ministry staff and our student life staff read this book together last summer and got together and discussed it. The biggest argument we had with the book is that she claims to be value neutral, which is to say she's just giving the information, but she's not going to say good or bad. But to a number, we said she's negative. I mean, she sees these things as negative. And I mean, it's a discipline to try to stay balanced. Another book that is actually getting old now, it's 5 years old, but it's Alone Together by Sherry Turkle. She teaches at MIT, and that raises the question, why is it that when we have never had so much contact with one another, that we also have more and more people feeling isolated? How is it that both of these things are true? And there is, I think, clearly some data there about embodied interaction and embodied presence with one another. So I'll turn to my last book here that I just read, and it's excellent. It's The Virtual Body of Christ in a Suffering World by Deanna Thompson. Deanna Thompson most recently has been a religion professor at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, though she is Lutheran. And I think she has just taken a position at St. Olaf. A couple of years ago, she was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, but her cancer was not diagnosed the way most breast cancers are diagnosed. It metastasized to her spine. And so she was diagnosed via a broken back. Her backbone was literally breaking as the cancer was growing in her bones, and you can imagine how extremely painful that would be. So her first book is a memoir on the experience called Hoping for More. For any of you who have or have loved ones experiencing cancer, I would really recommend it. It's a beautiful reflection on, faithful reflection on all she discovered as life held in a balance, and her life collapsed kind of in a second. But her second book is called The Virtual Body of Christ in a Suffering World, because she describes herself as inverted. She said she was very jaundiced about online communication, thought it was a pale, meager substitute for real community, for real presence, for all of these kinds of things. But because she was so debilitated, she was in awe of the kind of support she realized by a Caring Bridge. So they had a Caring Bridge site, and the kind of far-flung support that she documents that she got from them. So this is a substantive theological book, and she begins by reconsidering the work of the Apostle Paul and how really Paul's ministry was a virtual ministry. He was present in his churches very seldom, but what we have of his ministry are his letters. Letters, ink, paper, these are technology. They extended his reach, right? And so she uses that as an extension. But she's also very conscious of the dangers and the risks. So mostly what she's commending is that is virtual communication as an extension of embodied in-person presence. That it's a way to extend it. When, you know, so it's like the difference between an email or a Facebook message with a dear friend and with a stranger, you know. Or it gets at some of the dangers then when you say things online that you would never say in person, you know, and that happens. So she's seeing it as an extension of that, but her affirmation and her reflection on it is really crucial. Then the last chapter in the book is about the call to use it for the good of neighbor, the common good, that not to be aware again of the dangers of exploitation and so on. But I was really grateful to discover the book because there's probably room in my life for a conversion here, and it helped me offer a more balanced perspective on something that I think we're finding very disconcerting and very challenging. Just a second, because I've already forgotten to say this twice. In 2017, I got to travel with the Augustana Choir in Germany in honor of the 500th anniversary. And the course I taught with them, I called Living Reformation. And one of the immeasurable objectives I put down for the course was whether if learning about the 16th century Reformation could help us avoid a 30 years war in our own. The power struggles got so intense in the 16th century that it led to war, and the war went on and on and on and on. And when we watch abuses of power and how fast they can become universal via the communication technology we've got, I think that's a really significant question. And so the last thing I wanted to say was just, I hope that we can learn to be smart about this media and respectful of this power so as to avoid those kinds of abuses. Because then everything we said about violence yesterday comes into play again. It doesn't feel violent, but it is in fact very violent. Jeff, you had a...
You know, we all grew up with our older generation, our parents and older generations talking about how disgusting this young generation was and how they were growing up and being so disgusted and disconcerted with the way we were growing and what were we going to be like when we became adults. And I recognize the negativity of much that we're talking about with technology, but I also recognize that the church as it exists today is declining in terms of participation. And I think that we need to recognize that what we say or think is going to have about as much impact as what our parents.
Yeah.
That we need to move with it and find ways within this new and changing world to maybe have a church that is totally different than what we grew up in, or not have one.
Yeah. Well, that is happening. And in Thompson's book, she talks about a congregation that is totally online. They did not have a place for gathering. They gather online, virtually. And the kind of interaction they have and so on. And I have former students who are campus pastors at one of the state schools in South Dakota, and they're part-time because of budget restrictions, and they don't live in the community. So they've got a parish to serve besides. So it's very difficult to get traction. But they're getting enormous traction with a daily online devotional that they put out. And then it occasions them meeting some students at times. It is an entree. So it is a tool. And with any tool, it depends a lot how you use it, but it's certainly a very powerful tool. And I think as we prepare for tomorrow's discussion, one of the things, I'll do some summary at the beginning of tomorrow, but one of the things I think that is so disconcerting about today is we find so many things shaking the foundations. So we've got climate change, we've got this rapid diversity, we've got rapid technology, we've got all these changes that are kind of underneath us. It's a shaking of, and it's not just one or any one. And as Friedman points out, it's coming so fast we can't adapt to it. So you're right, the changes, I mean, we've got to move with the changes on a level. But I hope we'll move thoughtfully and prayerfully with those changes. One of my hopes for this week is that using the biblical parallels or the historical parallels in this instance will help us be present to our world in some ways. So as you think about coming tomorrow, please think about some ways you find it challenging to be present, or some ways, some things we've heard from the Bible will help us be present. Or that we've heard from each other. What are we hearing that helps us be more able to be present and hopeful? My hope is not grounded in making some particular thing happen. I don't think I would know what that could be. My hope is grounded in us being attentive and aware and available and engaged with what's happening. And I hope we can bring that to specifics tomorrow. Please.
I just thought, in light of what you just said about hope and we're talking about technology, I would share that one of my daughters asked me a couple years ago, will you please share some advice with me? And she wanted kind of life advice, and I'm like, oh, how do you create that? Where do I start? What do I, you know? It's too much work. I work full-time, I didn't have time. So we started this Wednesday Wisdom. I started it. I work in an elementary school, and I started taking pictures of things around an elementary school that are still relevant when you're an adult. You know, your mind can change and adapt, you know, whatever, stuff like that. So we started this Wednesday Wisdom text, my daughters and I, and now they curate stuff. We notice stuff. It's about mindfulness. And that's a very positive, once a week thing that we do. We're using technology, but it's very personal and it's positive and hopeful.
And there are things happening in lots of other sessions that I think are calling us to attentiveness. Feel free to bring that too. I think of what Cynthia is doing in her climate change and asking us to look at places that give us hope. So to talk about initiatives, whether they be online initiatives or multiracial, multi-ethnic kinds of initiatives that you're aware of in your communities, I think the world is not going to be changed from the top down. The world is going to be changed by grassroots re-empowerment. And that's what we will talk about tomorrow.
Yeah, just thinking about communities in the sense of what we have with communities in the internet age, kind of, there are instances where the internet has kind of caused a breaking down or is leading to a breaking down in institutions and communities. But I think that it's also important to note that it's allowed us to build communities as well where there weren't any before. It's allowed people who have at times felt very isolated to find one another, find out that there are other people like them. Thinking about Austin's first session on Monday, and people who had very different and disparate identities than they saw around them, suddenly being able to go online and find out, like, oh, there are a lot of people who have experienced the same experiences that I have.
That's exactly right.
Is a really powerful thing that has come out of this. And also, in light of what you're just talking about with Cynthia, you know, being able to find out, you know, especially with something like climate change, it can feel so big and overwhelming, and what can I do personally? Or I look around and nobody's doing anything, and being able to see there is hope, there are groups working out there, I can connect with them. That is something that I view as a positive thing.
So jot some things down as you're thinking today, and as you're aware of things. And tomorrow's session will be very little presentation, lots of discussion around hope. But you've already demonstrated you bring great insight, wisdom, experience. So we'll celebrate that tomorrow. And we'll what will shape the future? We'll say hope is going to shape the future. And we'll start with our engagement here. So thank you for the day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.